There are several reasons why, but I want to start with the most important one. They weren't good. The Marvels, I thought, was mediocre at best, and I think that Madame Web is an atrocity. It's almost as if the story comes second or even third. There's less emphasis on the craftsmanship, on the screenplay, on the characters, and you can feel it.
I am a husband, a father, a lawyer, a Christian, and a proud Canadian. I started this series because it was clear that our nation needs truth. Not just another biased narrative, but real information of substance. We need access to facts and the freedom to think for ourselves. I'm Leighton Gray, and this is Gray Matter.
Everyone is fascinated by the world of entertainment, but few of us know a lot about it. We're not insiders. So we thought it would be very fascinating to have somebody on the program as a change of pace who actually knows a lot about the entertainment industry, follows it very closely, but also had deep insight into how the entertainment industry impacts the broader culture. And his name is Christian Toto. Thanks for being with us again, Christian. It's great to have you back on the program.
My pleasure. You know, when I was a kid and I watched countless TV shows and didn't go outside, my mom and dad thought that was a terrible idea, but I really showed them. It's like, yeah, an oddly useful tool. Well, I mean, in my toolkit.
Yeah, you know, I'm old enough to remember the old Siskel and Ebert show, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I shouldn't say that because I don't want to date you too much. But I used to love, you know, following those shows and just learning about, you know, those guys knew so much about the history of movies. And I know you watch a lot of movies. You follow this very, very closely. So I'm interested in kind of getting your insights into some of the things that are going on in the entertainment world. Before we introduce you properly, as we always do, we're going to turn to our framing aphorisms, which have kind of a movie theme today. The first one is from Roger Ebert, who I just mentioned, who once said that no good movie is too long and no bad movie is short enough. From a man named John Crow Ransom, who said that too much is demanded by the critic, attempted by the poet. From Walt Disney, who said, "We are not trying to entertain the critics. I'll take my chances with the public." If only the current Disney company would follow that mantra, they'd produce a lot better movies. And then from Quentin Tarantino, very famous movie director, who said, "If I wasn't a filmmaker, I'd be a film critic. It's the only thing I'd be qualified to do." So who do we have on the show today? Well, it's Christian Toto. He's an award-winning journalist, film critic, and podcaster with more than 20 years experience covering Hollywood. He's a Rotten Tomatoes certified reviewer, and he belongs to both the Critics' Choice Association and the Denver Film Critics Society. He's worked in media long enough to know the vast majority of entertainment coverage leans to the left. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today, I hope. And he says that's why he created Hollywood in Toto 10 years ago, to give fellow conservatives a place where they can discover the latest news and reviews without insults. A very refreshing Hollywood in Toto. If you haven't checked it out, HIT, make sure you won't waste your hard-earned dollars on movies that are either too woke or insult your values. He says, "I didn't start out as an accidental culture warrior. His father, with an assist from Abbott and Costello, whom I'm old enough to remember, made him love movies. And so when his art career fizzled after pointing 3 degrees, he segued into movie criticism, and he's very, very good at it. But he says he's played the long game. He wrote local news and feature stories at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review while scrounging for any available arts assignments. He says a few came his way. Slowly, he invaded the Trib's entertainment section. So at that point, he started to shift his entertainment coverage, capturing this new Hollywood in a way most of his peers either ignored or applauded. So today, when Hollywood takes a lazy swipe at paying customers who happen to hold views outside the left of center consensus, sounds like Disney again, HIT isn't afraid to step up. And so Christian specializes in offering news, reviews, and commentary from a right-of-center perspective, which I have to say is very, very refreshing given, you know, how far to the left the entertainment world seems to have swung. In addition to that, he also has an excellent podcast that you should check out as well. So Christian, I wanted to start off with asking you about a big entertainment event that occurred recently. And this is, of course, the Super Bowl. It was for a long time. I don't know if it still is. You could tell me. It was the most watched event in the world, actually. And in recent years, it seems to have gone, like a lot of pro sports, sort of gone woke, gone to the left. There were some woke moments this year with the Black National Anthem, which I find a little bit confusing. Perhaps you can explain that to me. But I also read recently that the ratings for the Super Bowl were way up. So I'm interested to know from you why you think sort of pro sports, using the NFL as an example, sort of drifted left, and whether this improvement in the ratings this year, I believe it's about 40% better than last year, is a sign that maybe things are shifting from the left to the right. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think sports drifted to the left because everything has drifted to the left, because people who are on the left are weaponizing the culture in a way that people on the right often don't. So I think that's not a surprise. I do think that football did just that. And I think it was around the George Floyd protest era where things got a bit more pronounced. But I think that has been dialed back. I don't think you see many people kneeling when the national anthem is played. So I think there's been a bounce back in ratings. Listen, as far as this year's show, you had a very competitive game. You had Patrick Mahomes, who's maybe a once-in-a-generation talent. And you have the Taylor Swift factor, which cannot be ignored. So I think it's one of the very few places that seems to be still a way for all of us to watch the show, for all of us to get together. You know, my wife watched the commercials, and maybe your friend was a big fan of Usher and wanted to see his halftime show. Other people are just sports fans who want a great game. So all these factors come in. And I do think that sports in general have been nudging the woke aside. And I think some of them have been experiencing a bit of a ratings bounce back.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask you about some of the commercials for the Super Bowl, which for a long time have, for some people have been the most interesting part of the Super Bowl. But before we go there, I want to talk to you a little bit about Taylor Swift and her impact on the game. Obviously, she had her own box there, and she's in a romantic relationship with one of the players on the Kansas City Chiefs who ultimately won the game. There's even been suggestions that the game was fixed to help them win. But leaving all those conspiracy theories aside, something has arisen around Taylor Swift in the culture that kind of transcends entertainment. And that is, she's become so very popular, so powerful in the entertainment industry, that there's even the idea that she could impact the November presidential election in the United States. And people are talking about something called Swiftian normality. What is Swiftian normality, and to what do you attribute this immense popularity of this this female entertainer?
Well, you know, Andrew Breitbart, before he passed, said politics is downstream of culture, and it's one of his most profound statements. He's right. He was right then. He's certainly more right now than ever before. Pop culture does matter in so many ways. And so someone as talented as Taylor Swift and as popular, and I really can't think of anyone who's had this level of fame. Maybe Michael Jackson at his peak, right? Perhaps. Yeah. Certainly, yeah. The Beatles is another cultural touchstone. But to be that popular and to have a megaphone like social media, which Michael Jackson didn't have, and of course the Beatles didn't have as well, there's a lot of cultural heft behind it. So the fact that she could recommend a politician at this point, yeah, I think that could potentially move the needle. You know, she's left of center. She's been very open about that. So if she does make a statement, it'll be pro-Biden for sure.
Right.
But, you know, this isn't 2020. The Biden we see before us now is diminished. And obviously, intellectually, doesn't seem to have the snap of his younger self, and I'm being kind. So it would be odd for her to make this bold declaration that we need to vote for Joe Biden. And then you see this aged man who can barely put two words together on a stage. So it will be interesting to see what she does moving forward in the next 9 months. Having said all that, she became more political in the last few years, but the last year directly, 2023, when she hit the stratosphere, she really dialed back on politics. She did not get involved with elections. She did not get a lot involved with some of the arguments going on across the cultural landscape. So that was interesting. She actually really provided a unifying force in a way. She was super popular. She was selling out everywhere. She was the concert to go to for the entire year. And yet she didn't use her bully pulpit in any sort of way. So I don't know if that was an aberration, if she's holding her fire for 2024, or whether she decided maybe to draw back on politics entirely. I will say, if she does the latter, which is possible but unlikely, the press will not be happy, will not be kind, and the loving adoration you see from the press toward her will turn on a dime. So, you know, it's going to be a very interesting thing to watch as the months unfold, whether she will continue to be apolitical or whether she'd be more partisan, more strident. Because if she's not, she's going to hear about it, that's for sure.
So, Christian, I'm a big Elvis Presley fan, and I remember, I believe it was a 1972 documentary film called Elvis on Tour, where he was being pressed by a reporter in New York before a big concert he was going to do at Madison Square Garden. You might have seen this, where he's being pressed on his opinions about the Vietnam War. His response was, you know, he says, "I'm just an entertainer, honey, and I just as soon keep my opinions to myself." Of course, this seems to have radically changed in the world of entertainment. I'm curious to know why you think that entertainers now are so generous about their opinions about things such as politics and culture, the economy, the environment, and really most other topics, as opposed to a previous generation of entertainers who are perhaps, you know, more discreet about their private opinions because they were worried that their private opinions about things like politics might negatively impact their careers. What do you think has caused this shift? Or is it just sort of a sign of the times?
I think there's a lot of different factors here. One is, I think we're all more engaged with politics. We're all prompted to be more engaged by social media. That's certainly one thing. I think that, you know, In a different era, there was the impulse to get as big a crowd, as big an audience, a big a client base as possible. So if you're Johnny Carson, you don't pick on the Republicans solely or the Democrats because you want those huge ratings. You want to entertain both sides, and then you make a lot of money as a result because you're not chasing away half the country. So I think today's landscape, our entertainment landscape, is splintered. And today, a Stephen Colbert can be very successful by being very one-sided because he knows he's got half the country and a fraction of that will enjoy his work. So I think that's right. Going on as well. I also think that the structure of the media makes this more engaging and more more attractive to the stars because the media wants these kind of stories. If Robert De Niro for the 90th time says, "I hate Donald Trump," well, you're going to read a story about that across the press about that, about quoting him. And that will get, you know, clicks, that'll get attention, that'll get notoriety. So for Robert De Niro, there's no downside to saying, "I hate Trump." He's just going to get more attention. So I think there's that as well. I think that there's a groupthink in Hollywood right now where you are told to think a certain way, to have certain beliefs. And if you embrace them, if you shout them from the rooftops, there's a chance you can get more work. And this is what actor Nick Searcy has kind of taught me indirectly, is that this is when someone says something political, it could be from the heart, it could be something that's on his or her mind, or it could be a almost like a signal to my colleagues in the industry, "I think like you, I am like you, come hire me." And it kind of builds on that in a way. So I think there's a lot of different reasons for it. And but the bottom line is if a popular actress, Sydney Sweeney is all the rage right now. She's beautiful. She's young. She's talented. She's a rising star. If she came out tomorrow and said, "You know, I really do think there should be a border wall, and I love immigrants, but I really think we should do this. And I, as flawed as he is, I think Donald Trump is the answer right now." That would not help her career. That would hurt her career. And she actually might have to make an apology to resurrect her career. So when we talk about politics and speaking your mind, you're only allowed to say certain things. And unless you're as big as a John Voight or a Tim Allen, you will face repercussions if you don't toe the line. I mean, just ask Gina Carano, who was fired by Disney for The Mandalorian because she shared messages that weren't political, but they weren't in the narrative. They weren't the approved groupthink. And she paid a price for it.
Yeah, but she's done some terrific work on some of the Daily Wire productions, though, where she's been quite good. But just sort of advancing this thought for a moment, not so long ago, Tucker Carlson visited Canada. He came to Calgary. And of course, he's a very funny guy in his own right, or he can be. And he said something that really struck me when he was speaking to an audience in Calgary. He said, you know, Canada used to be known for producing really funny people. He said, where are all the Canadian comedians? And, you know, that really struck me. Like, we're not producing the, you know, the John Candys and the Jim Carreys of the world anymore. But that is kind of a byproduct of the woke, isn't it? I mean, it really is difficult for comedians to operate in that space when they have to be so careful about offending everyone, right?
It's right. It's an interesting point, because I do feel like there was that way. Maybe it was SCTV, maybe some comedians after that as well. But it did seem like there was this great spigot that was turned on. It was partially from Canada coming down into the Hollywood system. And also Saturday Night Live used to be,
yes,
you know, Bill Murray and Gilda Radner and Eddie Murphy and you know, Adam Sandler, Will Ferrell. You know, it was this an absolute flood of young, talented, very funny people. And even that is slowed too. But listen, woke does impact comedy. Woke means you can't say what you think. It means you have to say certain things and not other things. It means you have to be careful what you say, because you could be punished. None of those things help comedy thrive. It's just the opposite, mm-hmm. in effect. And you know, I'm not the only person to say, where are the funny movies? You know, I think some of the superhero movies are actually very clever and funny. But as far as the Step Brothers, the old school, The Hangover, Bridesmaids, you know, all the movies we've loved over the last 20, 30 years, they can be raucous. They can be sweet at the same time. Where are they? You know, we haven't seen that many. And I think if someone made a really good one and it was a little irreverent, I think it would make a ton of money.
Yeah. I mean, some of the movies that we enjoy watching, actually, when you order them now online, I'm sure you've seen this, they come with a warning. I just read about one that's a warning on Mary Poppins, the Julie Andrews Mary Poppins from the 60s. It gives a warning about discrimination. So just really, it's this woke stuff really has become ubiquitous. And I'm interested, I believe you were on a podcast recently, and you were talking about how pop culture actually shapes politics. And so I wonder if you could tie that in with this wokeness. I know you were talking about it a few minutes ago in the context of Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. But how do you think that this popular culture has an impact on politics? For example, the presidential election that's going on right now in the United States.
Well, you know, we can go back to Saturday Night Live in the early days when President Ford was depicted as a stumbling, bumbling fellow by Chevy Chase. Yes. Now, President Ford was actually a former athlete, and I think he did stumble once or twice, but they were more isolated incidents. But that became a narrative that certainly didn't paint him in a positive light. But I think the big moment in the culture was when Tina Fey, who's very, very talented, very funny, great writer, she portrayed Governor Sarah Palin during, I think it was 2008.
Yes.
And that was a very successful, very funny, very sharp, very pointed imitation. I don't think it was cruel, but it certainly didn't paint Governor Palin in a positive light. And I think people, because she was new to the national stage, I think that cemented her in the public eye in a way that really got a lot of people's attention. And by people, I mean comedians. And I think they realized the power that they have to shape a narrative, to impact the body politic, to make us think of certain things with certain politicians. And ever since then, I think that really did change how comedians do their craft for the most part, by and large. And I think, you know, what have we seen during the Obama years on SNL? We saw very few jokes that were making fun of him. We saw jokes involving that character, Obama, but it wasn't like they were being critical of his policies, of his demeanor, of the things he was up to. In fact, when he left office, Saturday Night Live produced a musical number, I think it was called To Sir With Love, basically honoring President Obama as he exited the stage after 8 years in office. It doesn't seem like the kind of thing a comedy show should do. And it's gotten much worse since then. I mean, you know, President Joe Biden is a flawed individual. He's deeply unpopular. And it sounds cruel to say, but they're pretending as if he is not in any way mentally you know, weakened by his current age. I mean, and it's awkward for me to even say it, because I'm trying to find the more polite words to say. It's you know, I don't want to be impolite and I don't want to be disrespectful, But that's where we are. I mean, that's where President Biden is at this point. And we've had basically 3 years where SNL has mostly had a hands-off approach. It's Trump, 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 Trump. And maybe we'll pick on Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz and other figures on the right. But where are the jokes about President Biden? He is the president. Saturday Night Live has this long and glorious tradition of speaking truth to power, of poking fun at the president. They don't do it now because they know that they do it, it's going to register in a lot of people's minds in a way that comedy is very powerful and say, hey, maybe this guy isn't up to speed. And again, you know, you could put out a news article, you can put out a white paper, you can do a lot of different things, but you have one killer sketch that goes viral that shows the president of the United States forgetting his lines, being addled, not being as sharp as he could be. That leaves a mark. It left a mark with Sarah Palin, that's for sure. And that's what they're afraid of.
During the time that Mr. Trump was in office, there was no hesitation to poke fun at him. And everybody saw what Alec Baldwin did with that character. It was a recurring feature on the show. And I saw recently a very funny bit from SNL alumnus Dana Carvey, who just deadpanned an impersonation of President Biden. Of course, he's so talented with those impersonations. But, you know, coming back to what Tucker Carlson said about comedians, he said something else that really struck me. I want to get your take on it. One of the functions of comedy in the culture is that it gives sort of the common people, the everyman, to see someone poking fun at the people in power. You know, all the way back to the old court jesters of yore, you know, there's one person in the kingdom who could make fun of the king. And when we lose that, we lose something very important, don't we?
I agree. I mean, it's a great American tradition is to make fun of the president. I mean, like I understand when President Obama was elected, there was a hesitancy in part because he was the first black president, and you didn't want to go anywhere near race in a way that'd be offensive. And I understand that it takes a special touch in a way, a delicacy perhaps. But you know, to be hands off on a President Obama, for example, is actually being disrespectful to him.
Yeah.
Because you should treat him like any other leader. Mm-hmm. He is the president. He earned it. He got the votes. We should poke fun at him. And I would imagine that he would understand that this is part of the process, is that every president gets made fun of. It's what happens. It's what it's a great leveler too. You know, he's the most powerful man in the free world. But if you turn on the Late Show, you've got a comedian making fun of him. And the next day, he's not hauled off to jail. I mean, I think that's wonderful. And again, if it's good satire, if it's on the mark, wonderful. You know, you mentioned President Trump. What figure could be more ripe for humor than President Trump? He's larger than life. He's bombastic. He's over the top. His preferred skin color is a bit of orange hue. I mean, all these things are fodder. But, you know, it's one thing I've noticed in recent months, and there have been some exceptions, that I don't find the Trump jokes funny anymore. And maybe it's because we've told them all. But also, I think some of them are mean-spirited. And I think sometimes that when they're mean, it doesn't really kind of land the same way. And Dana Carvey, who you mentioned, is a great example of just the opposite. I think his impressions are smart, they're funny, they're on point, but they don't ever seem vicious. And I think it lands better.
Yeah.
And so that matters. But also, I think a lot of political comedians are trying to land a partisan blow with the humor. So it's not about being funny. It's actually about saying, okay, we need to shape this in a way that's very negative and show Trump to be very negative. And then the voter will say, oh my God, I can't vote for this guy because of what he did. Look at this comedy bit. And I don't think that's what comedians should be doing. Mm-hmm. I think you could make that happen, but I think it does take a very delicate, deft touch to do both things, to be very funny, very satirical, and then also leave the person with the thought that, I don't think I want this person to be president because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
So it's important.
You make a great point about Trump because, of course, he can be very funny in his own right. Anyone who's seen that sort of skit he did about how Joe Biden's walk, his gait, but you make a point about being mean-spirited. And the thing about Trump is, although he can be very funny, oftentimes his humor is mean-spirited, and that is off-putting for many people. So that's a very incisive point you make there. Well, enough about politics. We have you on here because you follow movies. I'd like love to get your take on some of the movies, some of the ones that you've commented on. You mentioned Disney and Marvel. You know, there's a saying in the public parlance about go woke, go broke. But Disney does not seem to be getting the message. They keep producing movies that don't seem to be what the public wants to see. And maybe the best example of this is in the superhero realm. So there's a movie that came out recently called Madam Web. That essentially it was about casting women in the role of Spider-Man. And then there was another or Spider People, I should say. And then there's another movie, The Marvels, which had an all woman cast. Why do you think these all-female sort of woke casts of characters in superhero movies aren't really what the public wants to see and aren't doing well at the box office?
There are several reasons why, but I want to start with the most important one. They weren't good. The Marvels, I thought, was mediocre at best, and I think that Madam Web is an atrocity.
Your review. It was pretty
hard. I'm not alone in that assessment, by the way. I might have been more kind than my peers. But listen, I think we have to start there because we can dial it back a couple of years and look at Wonder Woman with Gal Gadot, the 2017 film. It was very good. It was very well received. She was perfectly cast, and no one complained about it. And no one said, oh, it's a female hero. I can't watch her. No, she's good. It's a classic character. The movie was very well put together. What's not the love? So I think let's not forget that. Right. Having said all that, I think that the genre we're talking about does skew to the male side of the gender scale in general. Yeah. I mean, there are plenty of women who love these movies, but there was a recent report, maybe 60 or 70% of the audience for superhero films is male. And so they may want more of a male skewing figure. So that's there too. But I think when we talk about woke, and I think it's an important word and it can be overused. But I think when it comes to Disney and the movies and their woke attitude is that there's something about this movement where we need to focus on diversity. We need to empower women. Mm-hmm. Nothing is wrong with either statement. It's wonderful to have different people of color, different backgrounds on the screen. It's wonderful to make female heroes. But there's something about that impulse where it's almost as if the story comes second or even third. There's less emphasis on the craftsmanship, on the screenplay, on the characters, and you can feel it. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, Black Widow, who's in the MCU, was a wonderful character for years. It was Scarlett Johansson. No one complained about her. So it's not about animosity towards female characters. It's more about the stories are mediocre or worse, and that the people making these stories, for some reason, it seems like when they focus on these woke elements, their eye is off the ball. They don't tell the great stories that they once did. I think that's a big part of it. And then I think there's also this sense that Hollywood, Disney's very guilty of this as well, insults the audience. It's, you know, there was a recent unnamed Disney executive talking about this very issue. And he said, you know, I just think that a lot of the fans, they don't want to, they feel threatened by a strong female lead. No, not true. Sorry. There are way too many examples where you're absolutely wrong, but that's what he's believing or she's believing. So.
Yeah. So Christian, this seems like a very strange reaction from a movie company that is in the entertainment business. It's almost like if someone owned a restaurant and they got mad at the people, at the patrons, because they didn't like the food. What's really strange is that Disney does not seem to care very much about how people are reacting to these movies. And I wonder, you know, I quoted Walt Disney off the top of the show. I wonder what old Walt Disney would think about this. You know, you commented though on another movie, a star-studded anti-Bush movie that attracted almost no viewers. Do you want to talk about this one a little bit? It's sort of in the same vein.
What's the title on that one?
It was, this is a story. Maybe this wasn't you. It was off your website. This is a story about Democratic presidential hopeful Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton gets a kiss from actor Rob Reiner at a fundraising event. There was this anti-Bush movie, star-studded anti-Bush movie. Do you remember this?
I was thinking, if you mentioned Rob Reiner, he did a film recently called God and Country. Is that where we were from?
Yes.
Okay.
That's the one I'm talking about. Yeah. Why is that one so unpopular in your view? And why is Rob Reiner making a movie that... I mean, because he's been so successful. I mean, Princess Bride and You know, Sleepless in Seattle, all these other movies. He's been one of the most successful directors. Why is he suddenly making movies that are so unpopular with audiences?
Well, here's the short story in Rob Reiner. Played Meathead on All in the Family, successfully segued to film director, and reeled off, you mentioned a couple of them, This is Spinal Tap, Misery, mm-hmm. Stand By Me, The Princess Bride, When Harry Met Sally. I mean, yeah. That is a track record that any director would kill for. So he's a very talented fellow, but he seemed to lose his mojo in the 2000s. He hasn't really made a successful film in quite some time. I think The Bucket List from 2007 might be his last hit per se. So I don't know why directors lose their skill, their chops. It's hard to say. It's a brutal industry, but he had a great run. No denying it, but he also has been maybe the most anti-Trump celebrity on the planet. I mean,
yes.
he puts Cher to shame.
He's very active on X in
yeah,
this regard.
Yeah. And yeah. So he recently didn't direct, he produced a movie called God and Country, which is this new thing where it's about Christian nationalism. It's the biggest threat to America. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's just another cudgel against President Trump and his voters. It seems very, I didn't see the film. I wasn't offered a screening link, but it just seems very, partisan, very angry, very one-sided. But he did get an enormous amount of free publicity, aka press, about the movie. So he was on CNN, he was on New York Times, all these different interviews. And the film came out. It was only in the 85 theaters, which is very small. But with these smaller documentaries, they often will open them small. And then if there's a lot of buzz, a lot of interest, you open it wider, you add more theaters. That's usually the way they want to do it. It's a rollout of sorts. But it's been out for about 2 weeks now, and it's just not making any money. But I think at the bottom line, it seems like an angry film by the reviewers, by what I've seen. And maybe this thesis really doesn't have a lot of weight unless you're an extreme partisan. Or maybe if you're an extreme partisan, you watch CNN or you watch other news outlets that reflect your worldview. You don't need to go to the theater to see more of it. That's just my hypotheses here as far as why it's not doing well. But, you know, if you're a movie maker and you're a filmmaker and you're a documentary storyteller, you want this publicity. You want all that attention.
Right.
It's the best chance you have at success, but not making it.
Yeah. Another angry movie that you didn't like very much was something called Driveaway Dolls. You want to talk about this one a little bit?
No, I don't.
You called it woke, dull, dumb, and more. Again, why are these films being made, and what didn't you like about this film and films like it?
We don't have enough time in theory. Listen, just a little background here. The Coen brothers have made some of the best films of the last 30 years. Big Lebowski, Raising Arizona, Fargo, you know them all. They're wonderful films. Mm-hmm, the two brothers have briefly split, and they've kind of doing different projects. So this is Ethan Coen doing a film, I think, with his wife, Trisha Cook. Mm-hmm. So certainly your expectations are sky high. It's a heist movie of sorts. It's a road trip movie. It's only 84 minutes. It's got the Coen stamp of approval. So everything about this is set up for success, but I just found it an absolute slodge to watch. It was dull, even though it was short. It wasn't funny, even though it was trying to be funny. It's about two lesbian friends. They're not romantically linked. They take this car to go to Florida, and there's something in the car, in the trunk, that they're not aware of. It's like kind of a MacGuffin in a way, this secret object. And so it's all about these, you know, they're going this way. The bad guys are chasing their car. Again, everything sounds great on paper, but not interesting, dull characters, an enormous amount of sex, but it's all sex that basically slows the movie down to a crawl. And it's not really exciting in any sort of storytelling way. I found the two characters not very likable. One is very reserved, but she's kind of dry and off-putting. The other is very sexually aggressive, but it seems like she's almost mean to her friend and pushing her into a sexual situation she's not ready for. So I could go on and on. It's an absolutely horrible movie. I predict it'll be my worst movie of 2024, even though we're only a little bit into the year. We'll have to wait and see. I hope this is the worst movie because I hope everyone's a little bit better. But yeah, it's not doing well in the theaters. It got mixed to good reviews from critics, my peers, and the audience reviews have been much more in line with my point of view. But there you go.
Well, folks, don't watch that one. But another film that you did like a lot was one called Ordinary Angels. This is a film starring Hilary Swank and Alan Richardson. Mm-hmm. You gave this one a fairly positive review recently. What did you like about that film?
It's quite a lot to like. You know, it's based on a true story, a remarkable true story. It's about a small town where there's a little girl who needs a liver transplant. Her dad is a widower, so he doesn't have money, doesn't have a partner. He's just trying to keep his little girl alive. And this neighbor comes along, played by Hilary Swank. She's like, you know what? I've got some skills. I'm a charismatic person. I could rally the community. I can talk to the doctors and I can maybe, you know, raise some money for you. Let's see if we can save this little girl. So that's the story. I've been calling it a faith-kissed movie because there is a faith element, but it's not very strong. And what is strong is a script. It's a very real, raw story. It could be formulaic. It could be predictable, but I think that there's enough rough edges in the story to make it more palatable for everyone. And Hilary Swank and Alan Ritchson are both excellent here. She's got two Oscars, mm-hmm. with no surprise there. You know, he's the big guy from Reacher, but this is a very different kind of a role. He really is just a dad struggling to keep his girl alive. And he's very effective. So I enjoyed it quite a bit. Not making a ton of money yet at the box office. I think maybe it'll have legs and people, the word of mouth will kick in. But yeah, it's a very satisfying, very sweet, very strong movie, and bring those Kleenex because your eyes will moisten a time or two.
Coming back to this question of comedians, you posted a piece recently on your website about Seattle Comedy Club cancels 4 unwoke comics. You want to talk about this one a little bit? Why you thought this was important to talk about?
Yeah.
You know, the caption is, "Think cancel culture is going the way of the 8-track tape? Try again." This was disappointing because for those of us who have been the subject of cancel culture, I really would like to see it go the way of the 8-track tape.
I would too.
So why did you feel that it was important to talk about this?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen some positive signs where comedians have come back after being canceled, or a cancel culture movement rises up and then doesn't really have much impact. I mean, I think that's a good thing. I think we should be a more forgiving culture. We shouldn't be a culture where you dig through someone's past and pick out something he or she said and said, you need to go away because of that. But what this case is, it was a Seattle club. It's in a very progressive city, in a very progressive part of the city. And they had hired to appear at the club 4 different comedians: Louis J. Gomez, Dave Smith, Kurt Metzger, and Jim Florentine. Now, Dave Smith is libertarian leaning. There's nothing that they have said specifically that should be like cancel worthy, but I would guess they were unwoke comedians, for lack of a better phrase. They don't really kind of lean in that direction. They're more free-willing, free-spirited. They say what they want to say. So, you know, if you don't want that in your club, I understand that. I think that's wrong-headed. But then don't hire them. So what apparently happened is that they connected with these comedians. They slotted them in their schedule. And then there was some sort of local feedback saying, we don't want these comedians in our club. And the club owner / booker said, okay, you're right. We're going to listen to you and we're going to cancel these gigs. And that's exactly what they did.
This wokeness, though, extends beyond the realm of comedy. And you commented on this in another piece you wrote, "Coddling Doc Destroys Woke Universities, Trigger Warnings, and More." And this has to do with college students detailing behind the scenes DEI and indoctrination. You want to talk about this story a little bit? I found this one was really fascinating.
Yeah, it's based on the book of the same name, The Coddling of the American Mind. And it looks at young people, college students. Most of the young people focused on in the film are from different countries. I think one from Uganda, one from Nigeria, one from India. And when they came to America, when they came to an American university, this is what they found. This sort of, you need to be a victim because of your skin color. You need to, you know, check out all these microaggressions that people are saying and using against you. And it disorientated these young people. They were young and smart and driven and ready to engage in the cultural experience of America. And they were just hammered by this woke ideology, this victimization. And it's all about that. And it's all about how, you know, at the end of the day, we will face adversity. We will hear things that we find offensive. We will suffer. We may have illnesses. We may lose family members. Life is hard. But when you protect people from all of these adversities, we get soft. We're not ready to go in the real world. We're not ready to fight off a boss who maybe is cruel to us, or deal with rejection, or maybe even enter the dating world and understand that not everyone that you like is going to like you back. So it's looking at the kind of the cultural around this woke ideology. And no, it is, it is encompassing. It isn't just comedy. It isn't just the business world. It's academia. I mean, I think it's strongest in academia. And so this documentary, which is not made in Hollywood, which is not available in a theater near you, is actually being shown via Substack, which is the newer platform for journalists who want to get their voices heard. So, you know, it shares some pretty interesting stories. And I think this is the kind of documentary that is not aggressively political. It's not saying left or right. It's not saying right or wrong. It's not saying Biden or Trump. It's not saying all these issues. It's saying, look at these students. They're suffering. This is not a good way to go about bringing up young people who are the future. And it's using very specific examples to show how they were, you know, how their mental health was affected by what happened.
Mm-hmm. A lot of what you're talking about today in the context of entertainment, Christian, it seems to me can be framed more broadly in terms of freedom of expression generally. You know, I think of back to John Milton in 17th century England, who wrote this tract, Areopagitica, where he basically said what you just said, and that is, if we're going to have free speech and free expression, we have to recognize that there's going to be forms of expression that are going to be offensive at certain times. In fact, you know, it's difficult to have any kind of meaningful examination of an issue or a meaningful conversation if you have to risk offending someone. And but it seems as though this wokeness is starting to run its course. It's not gone. But for example, the ultra woke outlet Vice Media just announced some mass layoffs. So would you agree that, because you're close to this, I'm very interested to get your take. Would you agree that perhaps freedom of expression is starting to make a comeback against wokeness, which is essentially censorship and suppression of free speech? Or do you think that we haven't seen the worst of what we might call wokeness?
It's a yes and no answer. It's yes, I think there are things that are improving. Yes, I do see signs of progress, but no, it is still out there. I mean, the Seattle Comedy Club is just one example. There are others as well. There's a pro-Israel singer, I think his name is Mattis Yatnu. I always stumble over his name. He's a reggae singer. He's popular. And he lost several gigs because of his views.
Right.
There's an actor, Brett Gelman. He's the kind of face you've seen before. He was on Stranger Things as well. And he just put out a new book. And he had two of his book gigs canceled. And again, I think he's a Jewish actor. And I think he's been speaking pro-Israeli sentiments in general. And, you know, he has suffered as well. But I mean, the bottom line is this whole impulse where you need to shut up because I've got the right views and I can't be challenged. I think that's deeply unhealthy. I mean, the bottom line is that if my ideas are correct and they are healthy and they are strong, well, then I could engage with you and we could argue about it. We could have a healthy debate. We can agree to disagree. And maybe in that process, I'll come to a new conclusion, or maybe you'll come to a new conclusion. To shut down debate is a terrible precedent, and it's happening across Western culture in many different ways, large and small. So I do think there are moments where what's happening in the culture, there are some positive signs. In America, a comedian who was canceled by Saturday Night Live was asked to host the show just recently. So that's Shane Gillis. So here was a case where a comedian, you know, he said some comments about the Asian community on a podcast. I thought they were crude. I thought they weren't funny. I don't know whether he was working toward a bit, he was in character or not, but I didn't like it at all. But it doesn't really represent him as a person. It doesn't represent his whole body of work. He's actually a sweet comedian who connects with people and who he's the hardest on himself. He's very self-deprecating. So, you know, over the years, in the past, if you were canceled by a major TV show, your career would just spiral into the pit. But he was able to build himself back up. He put his work on YouTube. He hit the comedy clubs. He was a podcaster still. And he built himself up to the point where Saturday Night Live said, you know what? This guy's pretty funny. Maybe we should have him on the show. So those are positive signs, you know? And again, you know, they are comedians. They're not politicians. And they are allowed to tell bad jokes. They can be tasteless. They could be offensive. They could be flat out unfunny. But part of being a comic is saying the joke, hearing the reaction, and then going back after the show and thinking, the show didn't that joke didn't land. What can I do differently? Do I need to tweak it? Is the wording wrong? Is the target wrong? Or is this just a joke that's not going to work? Out of the way. I'll try something new. It's called workshopping. Right. And a lot of comedians do that. That's how they make a good skit great. It's how they make a mediocre joke even better. And to take that away from them and say, well, we'll be so offended by this joke, we can't let it be out. Well, that's absurd. And, you know, we live in a time where just go Google the comedian. If Fred Smith's coming to the comedy club next door, I Google him, I watch his clips. Oh, he's pretty clean. I kind of think I like that comedy. Or he's outrageous, he's bawdy, he's dealing with sex talk. That's not my cup of tea. I'm going to skip that. No one's forcing me to listen to this. And this whole thing where, well, if I hear a dirty joke or I hear an offensive joke, it's going to injure me, it's going to harm me. I don't believe it. I think it's overrated and overanalyzed. And also, I don't think we should be, as a culture, so fragile that we hear the wrong joke and we're in a tailspin. That's not good. It's unhealthy.
Yeah. Well, in that vein, some of the guys over at the Daily Wire are making their own efforts. In fact, I learned about you from some of the work you've done on the Daily Wire, appearing on their programs. But they produced a film, a very kind of body film, called The Lady Killer or Lady Ballers, I should say, recently. Do you see that type of movie is going to make a comeback? If it's produced sort of independently by let's call it small C conservative producers like the Daily Wire, or do you think that there's still an audience for those types of films?
I still think there's an audience for those types of films. You know, it may be smaller than it was 10, 20 years ago. I think we've all collectively gotten to a point where we get a little offended a little more easily than usual. It's almost unavoidable in our culture. But I do think if the movie is funny and it's irreverent and its heart is in the right place, I think that's important too. You know, I look back to the American Pie films. It was about a bunch of horny teenage boys who wanted to lose their virginity or have sex or something like that. But at the end of the day, you know, I think one of the characters strikes up a monogamous relationship. Another person, you know, it had a sweetness to it that really kind of worked with the rowdiness, the R-rated antics. So I think that's maybe the better approach. And I think a lot of successful comedies have had that, like The 40-Year-Old Virgin. It's about a guy who's 40 and has never had sex. And yet when he meets the girl of his dreams, does he have sex right away? No, he waits till his wedding night. I mean, it's actually an oddly conservative message in the movie, teeming with dirty jokes and profanity and nudity. So there's something about that combination, which I think is very healthy and very funny. And I think that has an appeal with the American public or the viewing public in general.
Yes. Yeah. Well, thank you, Christian. This has been a wonderful conversation. We appreciate your time and your insights into the entertainment world. We've come to the point of the show where we have something called a reading list. And we want to highlight your book. You've written a book called Virtue Bombs. I read this book and I found it was just fascinating. It goes into a lot of the themes that you've been talking about today, but in greater detail. There's a wonderful foreword by Andrew Klavan, whom I'm a big fan of. I really enjoy his podcast. I think he's just brilliant. But this book is called Virtue Bombs. It's called How Hollywood Got Woke and Lost Its Soul: Inside Hollywood's Descent into Dreary, Dull Leftist Groupthink. And the description here is that Hollywood's dream factory is now a nightmare of woke restrictions, identity politics run amok, and freedom snuffing rules and regulations. The Oscars are unwatchable, as are many films and television shows, thanks to the woke revolution. Virtue Bombs breaks down where Hollywood went so wrong, illustrates the slow motion disaster infiltrating the industry, and offers a glimmer of hope for a woke free tomorrow. What inspired you to write that book, Christian?
I was approached by the publisher and I had a conversation with him, and he said, "We should work together. What do you want to write about?" And it didn't take long to think about that was the subject I wanted to write about, because I've been hearing about it, I've been reporting on it, I've been discussing it, and it's been very frustrating to me. So it was my first book, maybe my only book, but that was it seemed like a no-brainer. There was nothing else that I felt as passionate about, that I thought I need to kind of collect all these ideas into a book, because I so often write article after article. But the beauty of a book is you can kind of coalesce a whole bunch of ideas and draw up a narrative in a way to kind of connect the dots, which is what I like to do in my work as well. So yeah, it all came together that way. And writing a book is never fun. It's never easy. But, you know, it was something that I was so passionate about, and it was so top of mind, and there were so many things going on in the culture that made it more digestible for me as a task. Mm-hmm.
One of the senses I got from your book is that that I share your love of movies. You're clearly very passionate about that genre. And mm-hmm. and there's something of a lament there in the book about movies generally, because movies are obviously have been a very important part of your life, and you've dedicated yourself, your vocation, to writing about them and reporting on them. And so that was something that I really connected with, because I, like you, am a lover of movies and movie history, and you're obviously very, very knowledgeable in this area. But that was something that came through, was your love of movies. And my sense was that you wrote the book in order to expose some of these problems, but also to sort of promote the idea that we need to get back to making good movies that are meaningful to people and that that entertain them. Am I right in that sort of impression of your book?
I mean, I couldn't be happier with you saying that, because that I hope that's what I shared in the book. I wanted to share that with the book. You know, listen, when I was a geeky teenager and the girls wouldn't look at me, my buddies and I would go to the movies and go to a diner and then just examine the movie we just watched. We'd pour over it, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And, you know, when I wanted to become a film critic professionally, that's essentially what I wanted to do. I didn't want to talk about woke. I didn't want to talk about politics. I didn't want to talk about actors who don't like me or studios who don't respect my values. I just want to talk about movies. And I'm the naive part of me wants to get back there too, you know, and yeah. I didn't want to be a culture warrior. I didn't want to, you know, engage with these issues. I wanted to see a movie. If I loved it, I wanted to just shout it from the rooftops. But, you know, listen, you get older, life gets in the way, and the industry changed. So that's why I wrote the book. It's a primal scream. Stop doing this. Go back to storytelling. That makes everything better. And I think it does.
So, Christian, apart from your own book, which we are recommending, we're adding to our reading list today, are there any other books that you would recommend to people, or sources of information, websites, things of that nature that you would recommend to people if they want to learn more about movies and more about some of the things that you talk about and you write about?
Sure. You know, book-wise, I don't read as much as I used to. I'm so busy as an entrepreneur, but I do recommend people check out The Coddling of the American Mind, which we referenced the film version just recently. As far as other websites, you know, I don't know how new it is, but I really enjoy it. It's called World of Real, R-E-E-L. And mm-hmm. I feel like I don't know the author personally, but I feel like he has a similar sensibility to me. He also just has a love of movies. But when I read his site, I feel like I get perspectives that I don't see everywhere else. I feel like if you read Variety and, you know, The Hollywood Reporter, you get a very specific worldview, a very specific set of stories. It's very similar. But I think World of Real is a site where you get something a little bit different. And it makes me think, it challenges what I think about movies. So I really do enjoy that. And listen, I'm a biggest fan of Andrew Klavan, as you are. I was so tickled that he wrote my foreword. He was my one and only choice, and I'm glad he accepted. He's got a great podcast that looks at culture, a much more mm-hmm. spiritual look at culture than what I do. But and also Cameron Winter is his book series. He's yes. written three so far. They're wonderful mysteries. And he just has such a provocative, wonderful mind. And he's a great writer. So I'd recommend anything by Andrew Klavan, but those in particular, it's a wonderful new series. I think he's very infatuated by the character. I think he wants to keep on writing these stories and hopefully that he'll keep doing just that.
He's also a great movie buff in his own right. I learn a lot about movies. He sort of threads a lot of old films, classic films into the topics he discusses on his show. Which I really appreciate. In fact, he's directed me to some films that I didn't know about and that I've since watched and really understand why he likes them so much. And we like you very much, Christian, and we're very grateful for your time with us. I really enjoy all of your work and hope that it continues. And maybe you'll find time to write a second book. And maybe it'll be about, you know, the comeback of the non-woke movies. Let's all hope and pray for that. But I want to thank you so much for taking this time with us. And for being our special guest here today on Gray Matter, best of luck with all that you're doing with your podcast and all of your writing and everything that you do. Keep up the great work, because I can tell you, speaking personally, I really enjoy it.
Well, thank you so much. And thanks for the smart questions.
Thank you.